This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Maggie Takuda Hall is the author of Love in the Library. It's a children's book and a true story about her grandparents met and fell in love in Minidoka, a Japanese-American incarceration camp during World War II. The book is now at the center of an American discussion about censorship. Maggie, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you so much for having me.
Maggie, we're going to get into the discussion about what publisher Scholastic asked you to remove from the book in just a moment, and then what your response has been. But first, why did you want to write your grandparents' story?
Yeah, my grandparents' story is probably one of my favorite stories that we have in my family. And it's one that has really shaped how I understand the world and my place in it. But I had never considered writing it as a children's book or as a book at all until early 2017, when President Trump took office. And his very first executive order that he signed was the travel or Muslim ban. And I immediately felt so afraid and so sad for our future that I tried to think of what I had to offer in a period of time like that that was unique. And I realized I had this beautiful story in my family about not only the cruelty that those kinds of policies create, but also the incredible resilience of the people that they target. And so that's why I wrote Love in the Library.
And tell me a little bit more about your grandparents. How did they meet?
Yeah, so it is a true story. They really did meet in Minidoka. My grandmother, Tama, was the camp librarian. And every day, my grandfather, George, would go into the library and check out huge stacks of books he had zero intention of reading so that he could go flirt with her. And they fell in love and they got married in Minidoka and had their first son there as well.
So here comes the book. You submitted mm-hmm. it first to your publisher, and then Scholastic was interested, but they asked you to change some things. What did they want you to change?
So the book originally was published in 2022 by Candlewick Press, and then Scholastic wanted to license it. So take an already published book, but repackage it with their branding on it and stuff so that they could take it in directly to schools, which is kind of a special thing that only Scholastic does. They have these direct relationships with schools.
Kind of exciting for you initially, right?
Thrilling. Super big deal. I was so excited. But they had some edits, and from my understanding and the understanding of the sub-rights person at Candlewick Press, my offer was contingent upon them. And that was to my author's note, in which I connect what happened to my grandparents to things that are going on right now, other instances of state-sanctioned violence. And also, I called what happened to them racism, which to me is just a very basic understanding of what had happened. And Scholastic wanted me to remove an entire paragraph connecting them to any kind of other events in our history and in our contemporary times. But they also wanted me to remove the word racism altogether.
Why do you think did they want you to do that? What was their reasoning?
Well, their reasoning that they told me specifically and explicitly was that they worried the book would be limited in sales in this, what they called, politically sensitive moment. So basically that the divisive language would not appeal to the kind of people who are also working really hard to do book bans.
So tell me a little bit more about the purpose of an author's note. They weren't mm-hmm. asking you to change any of your story, but
right.
they did obviously make some significant requests of you with the author's note. What's the purpose of an author's note?
Yeah, so not every children's picture book has an author's note, but usually ones that are based on true stories do. And it's to help kids who are curious and want to understand the context of the story a bit more. But it's also there to help parents and teachers help talk to the kids about the story. It's a way of situating the story in a larger context. And not all the context always fits within the story when you're doing a picture book length book. And so belaboring the point within the text of the story, you might lose kids along the way. But if you put it at the end where grown-ups can see to it and then sort of communicate with kids about it afterward, you're just kind of giving a roadmap for how to understand the story to the readers.
And before we move on, I want to ask you this question that I haven't seen discussed. I thought the illustrations in the book, Maggie, they're beautiful. And they also tell the story about mm-hmm. what incarcerated life was like for tens of thousands of Japanese Americans who were incarcerated during World War II. Did Scholastic or others make any comments about the illustrations that you have in the book?
No, and it's worth mentioning the illustrations are done by an incredibly talented artist named Yazi Momura. And she came at it with such a clear philosophy of not sugarcoating the truth. And I really appreciated that about her partnership with me in this book, because this is our book together. We made this. And they did not have notes about the illustration. I think that would have really gone beyond the pale, because her work is so exquisite. I've never seen any criticism of what she did.
Maggie, are you aware of other publishers to other authors who have made similar types of requests?
Yes, but those are not my stories to tell. So after I came out in public about what had happened to me, people started reaching out to me with their own stories. But because children's literature as an industry is based so much in personal relationships, most people don't feel comfortable talking about the, you know, individual conversations they might have had with an editor. I've heard stories about being asked to remove whole scenes because from a book about Japanese incarceration because it was too violent. But it's also just an honest recounting of what happened to people in Manzanar. I've heard stories about people being asked to remove a gay character because they're a side character, and why don't you just remove their gayness because then it'll be easier to market. But so what I would say is, like, yes, this kind of thing happens, but usually it happens in the dark.
Maggie, we reached out to Scholastic and we asked them when and why the request was made for you to remove the text from your author's notes and whether they had made similar requests of other authors. We asked them whether it had been a matter of course for Scholastic to do that. And we asked them specifically if recent political concerns about certain subjects like race change their editing and publishing process. We invited them to appear with us. They instead sent this response. They said, from a spokesperson, Scholastic has a long and proud history of bringing stories and authors, including those that have been marginalized, to children. Even so, we are prepared to learn through our review process and how we may improve. We are confident that the process will strengthen us going forward as we continue our mission to bring literacy to all children. Mm-hmm. What's your response, Maggie?
I would say that sounds very nice. But there was a similar scandal with Scholastic about 15 years ago with an author named Lauren Miracle, who was asked to remove two gay uncles from one of her books so that it could be in the book fair program. And at the time, they said something really similar. And so I don't feel particularly heartened by their response. And having spoken with them directly, I did not see what I would call ample evidence of a durable process change to what's going on. To their claims of being a publisher that publishes diverse voices, they're absolutely correct. They do. They have published some of the absolute most important books for children. Melissa by Alex Gino is one of the first books about a transgender child for the third through fifth grade set, written by an actual transgender author. Their work is so important. But what's important to understand about Scholastic is that there's basically two major wings of the company. There is trade, and that's where they publish their own books, and books like Melissa, books like Heartstopper, some of these really beautiful, important, wonderful books. And then there's the education wing. And the education wing does some of its own publishing, but they also license books from other publishers. And education is much more concerned with sales than trade is, right? They handle the entire part of the company that goes directly to schools and sells to them. And so where the rubber meets the road for capitalism with them, they are much more conservative. And so I do think that they have been sort of laundering their claims for diversity through their trade department, who does do really great work, while also, with the other hand, limiting the kinds of voices that they include to the school market. And you know, it can be a little inside baseball, but I do think that's an important thing to understand, is that both of those things are happening at the same time.
Maggie, they kind of reversed course, as I understand it, and mm-hmm. said, okay, Maggie, we'll license the book. What then happened?
Right. So they apologized publicly, which I appreciated, and they made the offer to license my book in its intact form. And then I had a meeting with them. I had a meeting with the CEO and Peter Warwick and the president of their Education Solutions, who's Rose Else Mitchell. And here I'm the one who's kind of in the wrong because I don't remember everyone from Scholastic who was in the room. There were about three or four other people and then some people from Candlewick along with me. and the Asian American and Pacific Islander mentors who they had hired to help curate this collection, who they had not told they were going to ask this edit of me, were there as well. And in that meeting, it was pretty clear to me that the public apology was as deep as it was going to go in a lot of ways. And this isn't to say that I don't think that they meant it, and I do appreciate the apology, but I asked them explicitly, like, well, what happened? You say this is against your policy, so then what happened? And no one in the room was prepared to answer me. Personally, I probably would have prepared an answer for what I think is like a pretty basic question. So there was like a little bit of defaulting on just the recounting, like an honest and transparent recounting of what happened. And then I asked them, like, well, what are you going to do to make sure this doesn't happen again? And they said, we're going to hire an auditor. And I was like, well, that sounds nice, but that is very much pending the results of those audits. And also, like, what are you going to do with those results? I don't hear kind of what the plan is there. Time will tell, I think, the best on the efficacy of that aspect of it. And then thirdly, and to me, this was the most important, because I felt like in this moment, I was representing a swath of authors, not just myself. And it was, what do you say you stand against book banning. So what do you do to fight it? You're a $1 billion corporation. What do you do? And they said, we provide annotations, which from my understanding from the meeting basically means the marketing materials, like the good reviews the book has gotten, or like the blurbs that it's received. And for context, that kind of information is available for free on the Amazon page for the book. Someone has to put it there, but it's not hard to come by information. And then they said, one of the members of Scholastic is on a special task force with PEN America, which I think is great, but that's one employee of a $1 billion corporation, and it's not her full-time job. It's just a thing she does. And they said they also combat it with their curatorial process, which to me was the most galling response, because we were in that meeting because of a huge curatorial problem. And so none of their answers to my three main concerns were sufficient. And so I told them that they had not earned my trust with their current, you know, what they've accomplished so far. This story is really sacred to me, and I do not believe that they are up to the responsibility of distributing it. And I also told them, and I really meant it, that I hope that they keep us posted about what they're doing. Because if they make any kind of changes, it deserves to be celebrated. Like, they deserve credit. They've been put in a situation that other publishers haven't been put in publicly yet. And so they have a real opportunity to be leaders in this situation and to figure out how to effectively talk about difficult topics while not compromising their supposed values as a company while still existing in capitalism. I think that those things are possible. I think that they can do it, but it requires a minimum of spine. They need to be able to stand up and say, yes, this is just true. It is just true that it was racism that put Japanese Americans in incarceration camps during World War II. That didn't used to, by the way, that did not used to be a controversial opinion. In 1987, when Ronald Reagan signed the bill authorizing reparations to be paid to like a huge amount of the Japanese Americans who'd been incarcerated, he called it racism then. That was in 1987. That was Ronald Reagan. He's not exactly like an infamous woke operative. You know, this didn't used to be controversial to just call racism racism. And the powers that are trying to push for the complete erasure of that word are dangerous. And kowtowing to them preemptively will not serve anyone.
We're enjoying our conversation with Maggie Takuda Hall, author of Love in the Library. It's a children's book and a true story about her grandparents met and fell in love in Minidoka, a Japanese-American incarceration camp during World War II. And the book is now at the center of an American discussion about censorship. Maggie, NPR reported earlier last week that Scholastic, which had planned to feature Love in the Library as part of its Rising Voices Library collection highlighting the book, said it hopes to restart the conversation with you in the aim of sharing the book with the author's note unchanged. and it wasn't clear whether or not you're considering or still considering their revised offer. Do you have any update for us?
I do. I ultimately said no. I did not believe that they were making changes that would protect other marginalized authors from facing a situation with them like this again. I would love to be wrong.
Maggie, you talked about this briefly earlier, but I want to expand upon it now. It is true that in communities across the country and here in North Dakota, that there is an organized political attack on books in schools. That's a fact.
Yes.
Last year, a school board committee in Muskego, Norway, Wisconsin, rejected an earlier school board decision to buy 60 copies of the award-winning book When the Empire Was Divine.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other examples, too. A friend of mine, Sam Mahura, was asked to speak in Florida schools and later had to not have a discussion. He was interned at Heart Mountain. He's now 90 years old and on the board of directors of the Wyoming Heart Mountain Foundation. So my question to you, Maggie, is what do you tell policymakers today?
To legislators, I would caution them about this kind of censorship and book banning because it is the framework for doing bodily harm to people. I don't mean to sound alarmist, but as somebody who's both a Japanese American and a Jew, I find the book banning movement incredibly threatening and frightening because first you come for their voices and then you come for their bodies. And not being allowed to tell the truth of our own history is so un-American at its core. It is so deeply un-American, and I want to know where those free speech absolutists are while our words are being ripped right out of our mouths. It is such an embarrassment for us as a nation that a man who was incarcerated in Heart Mountain, who just wanted to share his story with the students who would become wiser, better, more resilient people because of his story, were cheated out of that opportunity because of right-wing fear-mongering. It makes me deeply sad, and it makes me deeply afraid. And I hope that politicians start being a little bit more clear about where they stand on this so that we know when we go to vote.
Maggie, how can this country have a deeper understanding and the need for constructive dialogue to address the challenges that you just talked about, challenge of race and racism in American society?
I mean, I'm not a doctor, but by my reckoning, it's very close to how interpersonal problems work, right? Like when you do something bad to somebody, you kind of have to start with an honest recounting and an apology. And an apology that doesn't come with any changed behavior is an empty apology. And right now, marginalized people in the United States have been given so many empty apologies. And the truth of what we have experienced has been obfuscated and lied about. I don't think that there is any chance for progress and for positive change and for us eventually being able to move away from what is frankly an exhausting, constant argument about racism without just accepting the fact that it has existed, it has defined our country, and if we pretend anything less than that, we're lying.
What's the response been to your book?
In general, it's been very positive. I hear a lot from, you know, other grandchildren of the incarcerated and even great-grandchildren of the incarcerated who feel seen and are so glad to see their stories being shared. I've heard a lot from other people who've had family who met and fell in love in these incarceration camps. I recently heard a story for the first time about two teenagers who met in one, and they would go to the men and women's showers at the same time, but they would choose the shower right next to the little wall that didn't go all the way up to the ceiling so that they could sing to each other while they were in the shower, which I think is one of the sweetest stories I've heard. And I hear from teachers and from educators who are glad to have had a text that could help them broach these kinds of difficult conversations. And about once a month, I get an email that is deeply angry at me, that considers me bitter, that tells me that my tone is wrong, or that calls me racial slurs, or tells me to go back where I came from, or that wishes death upon my children. It really runs the gamut, but mostly it has been positive.
Some of the same racial slurs, by the way, that were probably thrown at your grandparents back during World War II times.
Yes, not as much has changed as you might have hoped.
What's next for you, Maggie?
Oh, gosh. Well, mostly I just want to write for kids and teenagers. And I would love to get to the point with this situation where I never have to talk about it again. I hope that Scholastic does the right thing. I think they have the resources and the ability to do it. And I hope other publishers are watching.
Maggie Takuda Hall, author of Love in the Library. It's a children's book and a true story about her grandparents met and fell in love while in a Japanese-American incarceration camp during World War II. The book now is, as we've discussed, at the center of an American discussion about censorship. Maggie, it was a pleasure visiting with you, and best wishes.
Thank you so much for having me.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Bird Note. As a tree swallow swoops gracefully across a marsh, its long, slender wings glint a deep, iridescent blue. It glides close to the surface, tips its head down, and lightly skims the pond for a second with its beak open, drinking on the wing. Many birds drink while standing, dipping their beaks into a pond or birdbath, taking a beakful, and then tossing their heads back to swallow the water. And most birds can't pull off a daredevil in-flight drink because they just aren't built for it. Swallows are such virtuosos of flight that their skimming the pond almost looks like showing off. Drinking on the wing suits swallows best. They walk awkwardly on the ground on rather short legs, and their long wings are pretty cumbersome, so it's far more efficient to grab a drink on the glide. This adaptation holds true for some other birds, too. Common nighthawks are much bigger than swallows, with a 2-foot wingspan. They take their water in flight, too, while swifts, with an even longer winged structure than swallows, have such short legs that they never land on the ground. And so a sip on the wing is all but essential. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Cheers to more Bird Notes that we'll bring to you throughout the spring and summer on Main Street. Later in the show, we'll go foraging for food with chef and author Alan Burgo. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
There being 71 ayes and 61 nays, House File 2292 is repassed, as amended by conference, and its title agreed to.
With the clock ticking on the final days of the 2023 legislative session, members of the Minnesota House have approved language of a conference committee designed to fund and set policy for early childhood programs in the state. The legislation was sent back to conference committee last week and was returned for approval this morning. Officials say navigating early childhood programs in the state is fragmented, messy, and confusing. Proponents of the bill said by passing the bill into law, the Great Start Scholarship idea would bring programs together, streamlining the process. And by approving the bill, at least one lawmaker said it could bring a large payoff for the future of Minnesota.
What we're going to do in doing this is we're going to get every kid in Minnesota off to the great start that they deserve. At least we're going to put ourselves on the path to do so at a time when it makes the biggest difference. Members, let's come together. Let's vote green. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Lawmakers have until next Monday to complete their work. Minot police arrested a suspect in a fatal shooting at a nightclub early Sunday. Travis McDermott, who is 40 of Minot, is being held on charges of manslaughter, reckless endangerment, and extreme indifference with a weapon. The victim is 32-year-old Grayson Sletto of Willow City. Police say the shooting happened around 1:45 a.m. at the original bar and nightclub. Court documents say investigators relied on surveillance footage from the nightclub to charge McDermott. The footage showed Sletto approaching a table where McDermott and his girlfriend were sitting. The two men exchanged words before McDermott brandished a handgun, at which point Sletto pushed him to the ground. McDermott then fired the handgun at Sletto, hitting him twice in the torso. Police say bar patrons detained McDermott until officers arrived. And North Dakota Game and Fish is reminding people this Aquatic Nuisance Species Awareness Week of the danger of non-native plants, animals, or pathogens, and what they pose for North Dakota's ecosystems. ANS coordinator Ben Holland says battling invasive species in our lakes and rivers isn't just about recreation.
From a water infrastructure side, keeping these species out of our waters will prevent water infrastructure from being fouled and contaminated. And any time that happens, that fouling happens, those expenses, costs with cleaning water intakes and pipes and stuff is passed on to our water consumers here in North Dakota. So we want to both keep those species out from the recreation standpoint and from the water infrastructure standpoint.
North Dakota currently has low numbers of aquatic nuisance species. Other than zebra mussels, we have just a few invasive plants and animals. They include curly-leaf pondweed, Eurasian water milfoil, flowering rush, and bighead silver and common carp. Holland says it's a shared effort to keep these species from spreading.
You can be your own watercraft inspector every time you're out there on the landscape. Make sure that you're looking at your boat, removing all plants, animals, mud, vegetation, draining all your ballast tanks, draining your live well bilge area, and then allowing all equipment to dry. So those three simple steps, clean, drain, drying, can really go a long way to preventing ANS spreading in our waters here in North Dakota.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And would you eat this? A wildflower creme fraiche? Or maybe black walnut ketchup? Stinging nettle soup? Or did you know that you can eat hostas? We are going to visit now with Alan Burgo. He is a forager and a chef of the aptly named website, foragerchef.com. Alan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
We're talking about your book, The Forager Chef's Book of Flora, Recipes and Techniques for Edible Plants from Garden, Field, and Forest. So I want to start with this approach, this mindset to thinking about plants, as you refer to them in the beginning of the book as spontaneous plants, as what other people refer to as weeds. Can you talk about your mindset as you look at plants and think about food?
Yeah. So in North America, in the United States, we tend to think of plants as just weeds, wild plants as just weeds. And in Europe and around the world, one thing that I started to see when I was doing research for my book is that there's a lot of colloquial names for wild plants and pet names, and they roll off the tongue a lot better than weeds. So in Italy, they're known as piante spontanee. In Latin America, you have quelites. In Japan, you have sansai. And these are all kind of a blanket term that describes a multitude of edible plants. I was just at an event with my friend and mentor, Sam Thayer, and he was giving a talk about the Mediterranean diet and said that in some of the studies he looked at, people might pick 400 different edible plants in the Mediterranean.
Wow.
Yeah. So I thought, but I saw this connection between different cultures around the world, you know, that probably we could say they probably didn't have contact with each other. So this describing plants with a blanket term, like all these edible plants, it seems I almost want to call it like a human universal for enjoying this huge variety of wild plants.
Why did you want to go with the name Forager Chef?
Because it's concise and to the point and extremely descriptive in this, the few words that it is. And I was a chef before I was a forager, but those are the two biggest components of my life. And I spent about 15 years in professional kitchens and kind of picked up the habit of finding things in the woods and teaching myself to cook them along the way.
Yeah, what started your interest in foraging?
Well, when I was at Heartland Restaurant in St. Paul, it was I tell people it was like being a Green Beret. We changed the menu every single day, every day.
That's so much work.
And we only used products from within 200 miles of Minnesota. And I would be writing the menu for my station, which was the busiest station. It could have 13 different dishes. When we opened, it was like 13 different dishes that I would change every day. And as I was working through the seasons, I started to see all kinds of like hyper local, you know, the products of micro seasons almost coming into the restaurant that I'd never seen before. And it helped me see the Midwest and the ingredients that we have as something that was really, really special. And it was things I'd never seen before. Yeah. And I'm an unusual case because I got spoon fed, you know, some of the best and most prized ingredients in my region before I'd ever seen them in the wild. So I had just put chicken of the woods mushrooms on a menu. And then the next day I was out playing disc golf in the morning and I saw a chicken of the woods mushroom and I knew immediately what it was and what I wanted to do with it and that I could eat it because I'd already touched it, tasted it, cooked it, put it on a menu. You know, it's a very intimate process. So I feel very lucky in that regard. But after that, I got kind of obsessed and I understood immediately as like a light went on and I thought, oh, this is not some unattainable thing. This is more about timing with plants. And then with mushrooms, we're probably going to need some rain in there. So then I bought myself every piece of mushroom literature I could. And I moved on to plants later because sometimes you go out and the mushrooms are finicky and they don't want to show.
Yeah. You just used a really wonderful word, intimate. Tell our listeners about your relationship to food, and specifically when it comes to foraging, the relationship that you have to have with nature.
The relationship and the appreciation for where I live is something I never expected. I never expected to be so powerful. I like to explain it to people in the terms of like instinct. You know, that most people in the world are going to be descended from a forager somewhere along the line. And our bodies are like naturally hardwired to get excited when we find food. So I think one thing that people may not understand about foraging is it's very exciting. Your heart will pound and it's like a giant edible scavenger hunt. But now, like any time during the growing season, once the growing season starts, we're really in the boom time for greens right now.
Yeah.
Now I don't even need to go outside. I can look out my window and I can see the size of the leaves on my hawthorn tree. And I will know, okay, there's probably black morels in the north that are ready. There's going to be morels starting in southeast Minnesota. There's about 20 different types of edible greens I can go and pick right now today. And those will change. They could change by the day, depending on where you are. So the instinctual part was like, it was like awakening something in me. And it was so cool. Kind of like having like my ancestor's bike in a garage and all I had to do was hop on and ride it.
There are a number of recipes in the book that even I didn't know, for example, that you could eat hostas when they are still young enough. And as we are coming into this first blossoming of spring, for people in this sort of zone 3, zone 4 area, what should we be thinking about right now as food that we can go out and gather ourselves?
Well, right now is the best time for greens. I will pick 200 to 300 pounds of wild plants to eat during the course of the year. Some of those will be for events, but there's so many greens. I can go outside and in a good patch. You know, one of the things about foraging that is so incredible is just bearing witness to like the gluts of nature, because it's not like a small amount of food I'm gathering.
Right.
I can gather 30 pounds of wild greens in about an hour in a very good patch. That could be watercress, that could be purslane, that could be galansoga, that could be nettles, dame's rocket, garlic mustard. I mean, the list goes on mm-hmm. and on and on. And just the amount of things that we can pick is just kind of staggering. But wild greens, the mushrooms are starting right now. We'll have pheasant backs coming out. Then the morels will come kind of at the same time. If we get a flush of rain at the very end of morel season, we'll see the first flush of the best chicken of the woods mushrooms of the year. But right now, what I'm really focusing on is greens. Mm. And an interesting thing is that the greens could also be, they don't necessarily need to be on the ground. There's an invasive tree, the Siberian elm, makes these wonderful things called elm samaras, and it's the unripe seeds. It's almost like a miniature pea in this very soft, tender green coating, like a green papery husk, but it's very tender. And you can just strip them off the tree. It's an invasive tree. You can strip them off as much as you want, and you can collect gallon bags of these and just eat them by the handful. They're tender and sweet mm. and mild. Then we have basswood leaves. You can just take off the tree. They'll be almost translucent at this point. They taste like a combination of green beans mixed with sweet peas, and they're tender, delicious, and they're not bitter at all. But I also like bitter greens. So dandelions, they're going to be at a good stage now. Ideally, you want them before the flowers come. They'll be the most tender, but it's nothing that a quick blanch in some salted water can't fix. Then there's other bitter greens. Sow thistle leaves. Canadian lettuce is probably my favorite. Tall blue lettuce. Lots of different bitter, wonderfully bitter plants that are great with to make into kimchi or cooked with garlic and anchovies and hot chili like the Italians would. And then, you know, anointed with extra virgin olive oil and a big squeeze of lemon. It makes my mouth water just thinking about them.
We're visiting today with Alan Burgo about the book, The Forager Chef's Book of Flora, Recipes and Techniques for Edible Plants from Garden, Field and Forest. Recipes here like spruce tip key lime pie and black walnut ketchup, hosta, kimchi. Alan, you know, there's this joke among mushroom foragers that all mushrooms are edible and some only once, the strict definition of edible notwithstanding for the sake of the joke here. But can you give us some resources on how first-time foragers can know what's going to make you sick? Or maybe dandelions are okay, but you need to be aware that cities, for example, spray dandelions. And so what to look out for and stay safe while you're foraging.
Yeah, so just like many other things in life, foraging is a learned skill. And I like to describe the process of learning as like a toolbox. So there's a lot of different tools that I use for different purposes. And you can use them all kind of in combination. So one of the first tools, and the one that makes it the easiest way to learn the fastest, is going out on a foraging walk with an expert. And there's a number of them in my area around the Twin Cities and Western Wisconsin. There's ironwoodforaging.com, my friend Tim Clemens. There's Four Seasons Foraging with Maria Wasserly. Ariel Bunkowski by Duluth is probably the most talented mushroom identifier that I know, and they are all very, very good. Sam Thayer will also do occasional events. So learning in person is the fastest way to learn, where someone just says, here, this is what this is, you can eat it. And you also have field guides, and those are also an important part. Just like everything else I've been talking about, they're kind of a learned skill. Facebook groups, the advent of Facebook groups, these weren't always around. And what you can do is you can join. There's Facebook groups for foraging mushrooms and plants, sometimes mushrooms and plants, for just about every state in the United States. And sometimes multiple groups, like Minnesota has at least four or five. And you can go join one of these groups, and you don't even have to post anything. You can just watch what other people are picking. And you can see what the most common things people are picking in your area. then there's also, and sometimes some of my peers will disagree a little bit on this, but plant identification apps can be a good way to get a head start on things and to give you an idea of what something might be, or to help you just identify something to genus, but not maybe not specifically to species. So what that might mean is, if I can tell that this plant is a brassica, or if it's related to broccoli, or in the, you know, then I know all of them are edible. So I don't even need to know, I don't even need to know the species. You know, there might be 15 different varieties of wild mustard around where we are. They're all edible, and I don't even need to know exactly which one it is. But the plant identification apps are, they can be imprecise. One time it told me that a dog turd was a pine cone. You know, so you will have aberrations there. So like I said, it's one tool in a kit, and it is one tool. It's not the only tool, and they need to be used in combination. But the good thing is, the great thing, like I talked about before, our instincts, we undervalue them. We have a tendency to undervalue them. And once you know a plant, once you know a mushroom, once you pick a golden chanterelle and you smell this incredible fruity apricot aroma, you find another one, and it will be like picking, there will be no difference in picking a mushroom or a plant that you know than there is taking a banana off the shelf at a grocery store.
There's also this idea, Alan, about we don't only have to use one part of the plant or a specific timing for the plant. I mean, famously fried green tomatoes, but you also have recipes in the book like a green pumpkin pie or an immature sunflower head. Talk to us a little, if you would, about knowing how to use plants before the easiest way to use them.
I'll pick my favorite example. Wild food taught me about vegetables that I thought I already knew. So I spent, you know, many years in kitchens. I felt like I'd cooked with just about every sort of heirloom varietal that I could, of like everything. And I was out in the gardens at the farm I was living at, and I saw this plant growing, and I saw these big, thick, juicy shoots that were creeping around the ground. And I looked at it, and my mouth started to water. And I cut a few of these shoots and I brought them inside. And after doing a little research, I realized that I had never seen a pumpkin plant growing in a garden. And then I saw that pumpkin and squash shoots are used around the world. And of course, they'll make flowers too, but the shoots are edible. And they're used in Nepal, in Nepalese cooking. They're used in South American cooking, and there's a soup called sopa de guías, where they use like every part of the plant at different stages of growth, and they make it into a soup with little masa dumplings. And I thought it was just so cool. I started to kind of apply that technique to other plants to find interesting parts of them to cook that I thought maybe could be underappreciated, or we just didn't know about, that would taste good.
Do you have any tips, Alan, for people who want to be advocating on a larger scale? And I'm thinking for cities, they have restrictions sometimes on if you're allowed to have chickens or if you're allowed to plant anything besides grass.
Well, the dog that barks gets the treat, as the saying goes. So I think one of the ways that we can help enact change, which I definitely, that's kind of a separate conversation and one that I'm also passionate about, is by making noise about it. We need to contact people that are making laws and let our opinions be known. You know, there's a lot of these plants that we're harvesting are non-native invasive species. And technically it may be illegal to go to a city park and harvest them, but it is in no way unethical at all. So we need regulation, but getting there has been kind of an interesting process. And I think we will get there, but contacting people and making your opinions known, I think, is one of the best ways to do that.
Alan, in addition to the risk of ingesting food that is poisonous or toxic, there are also diseases that one can get if you're not careful. You, on your blog, Forager Chef, talk about getting Lyme disease from a tick, and you had to really overcome some significant challenges.
Yeah, I got Lyme disease, and I got Lyme. I had two deer ticks that were embedded in me, and I was careless and kind of reckless, and I just picked them out and tossed them off and went on my merry way. And then I got very, very sick. And, you know, you don't make a lot of money in the restaurant industry. I had no health insurance. I couldn't afford an apartment. I was living in my friend's basement. And then I woke up and half of my face was paralyzed. I couldn't talk right. I couldn't see out of my eye. I had to wear earplugs because my ears were very, very sensitive. If a pan clinking together was like a gunshot going off next to my ear. And then there was mental stuff going along with it as well that lasted. And as well as interacting with pre-existing conditions, I had kind of scrambling my neurology a bit. And it was devastating for me. It was very, very difficult. I got through it by a little bit of luck and perseverance and kind of never giving up. And I also got a tip from one of my friends at the DNR, and I started to spray my clothes with permethrin, which is the best thing that I've found for keeping ticks away. And I think the silver lining is that I can now be a Lyme disease awareness advocate, and every year I share my experience with my readers, and every year I'm just blown away because I get these messages in my inbox of the struggles people have gone through, and it needs more attention. There was a Lyme disease vaccine, but it kind of got scrapped. The rumor mill would say that it's because some companies couldn't make as much money on it as they wanted, but we could have a vaccine. And I think that needs more attention because it's not just Lyme anymore. There's Babesia, there's Starry, which is, I think, one of the scariest, which will give you an allergy to red meat. There's, and a host of other ones.
Yeah, Radiolab is a whole episode on that.
Yeah. So it's something that people need to be aware about, but it's also just kind of part of the way things are, and you just need to be aware. And I didn't want to let it keep me from being outside doing what I love, and I don't think it should keep anyone from doing it.
Alan Burgo, his website is The Forager Chef. The book is The Forager Chef's Book of Flora, Recipes and Techniques for Edible Plants from Garden, Field and Forest. He is a James Beard Award winning chef. Alan, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me on. It was great.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org. And by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally, working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well at all ages.
Today's Dakota Datebook is part of an ongoing weekly series produced in partnership with the Department of Public Instruction on Indigenous Peoples themes.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 1 is about sacred relatives. It states, Native people practice a deep interconnectedness with the land, the resources, the water, all living things, and all human beings. Land stewardship, respect for all two-legged, four-legged, winged, crawlers, and swimmers, and a strong belief in the sacredness of all human beings are key elements for our spirituality.
On today's Dakota Datebook, we'll hear about the traditions for getting ready for winter from Angeline Fourth Iron Road, elder from Standing Rock.
Being raised with a grandparents So these things that we have to do. So we get ready though for winter. Like, oh, they used to have a big garden, all the big garden stuff, and put them in root cellars or either in the house. You have a little, I don't know what you call them, the little cellars, and then put them in there for the winter too, because there's no fridge in them days when my grandfather was. So we learned how to make what's now cherries and we dry meat. We help our grandmother, and then the tripe from the cow, the stomach, that's what we help clean. And then my grandmother always teach us how to, we want to play, but we have to learn these things. So I'm glad that they taught us all this, and then it should go on, but nobody does all those things. Everything now, since it's all this EBT and all these things are coming on, they want the fresh pizzas and cold meat. They don't think about how they're going to survive the next day, because if that runs out, then there's nothing to eat, and then they don't know how to put a garden in. But being there for them, I teach them, you should just do it around your house, get a little shovel, do this. But, you know, these are the things we need to teach the younger generation.
I'm Scott Simpson. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
It's that time.
Uncle Pigeon, if I go when I do, NPR Tiny Desk.
We are Pegasus. This is our Tiny Desk contest entry.
What's going on, Tiny Desk? It's your boy, Bob Hayes. I am currently at school.
Just some of the thousands of entries in the 2023 Tiny Desk contest. The winner? Find out on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
There's 5 hours of Morning Edition every weekday here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this edition of Main Street. Thank you so much for joining us. You can hear this and past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Tomorrow on the show, Main Street visits Trinity Health's new hospital in Minot. This is the first of 4 reports, and we'll tour the remarkable facility. Plus, Jessica Runk was born and raised on a farm in rural North Dakota, but the love of acting and writing took her to Los Angeles. She'll join us to discuss the current writer's strike. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow on Main Street.